Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about the program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 87, where Ralph, Sarah, Pedro, Tom, and our special guest Paul Kahn are discussing Sun Tzu's book known as The Art of War, written sometime around the 3rd century BCE in China. In part two, we will continue to examine the many ways that the book has been adapted to contemporary matters. If you missed part one or to get the text, they are available on our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. We cover quite a bit of ground, and at the end of part one, we sort of transitioned into how is Sun Tzu being appropriated for other, you know, in other fields or other topic areas. One of the things that was going through my mind was some of the episodes in which we've done in the past, where indeed we take a classic author's work, and sometimes there's a myth or a, you know, some other construct that sort of comes out of it that doesn't actually come in the original work. Episode 3, Maslow's Pyramid, was not from Maslow. It was actually crafted separately from Maslow, but gets attributed to him. How much of Kurt Lewin's work, Kurt Lewin, was ignored in favor of this one offhand remark at the end of his text that turned into unfreezing, moving, refreezing. And I sense Sun Tzu is perhaps a case study in that because, you know, to begin with, for the reasons we talked about in part one, it's a very, very simple text. It's a very simple form of writing that is just naturally lends itself to being adopted liberally in other contexts. It's easy to divorce it from its original context and add new meaning. And of course, the Chinese, there are so many words and so many phrases in here that are difficult to translate. And so the translations themselves may lend themselves to interpretation, misinterpretation. So what I did, for myself, I actually went out and took a look at a couple of texts and bought one, which are among these texts that try to apply the art of war to something else. And I won't say what the book is because it's one I wouldn't recommend anyway. But if I was to characterize what I see in some of these texts, it's almost a deliberate misappropriation where you take, for example, in the one book that I did read cover to cover, if I was to put my hand over all of the parts that reference Sun Tzu and just read the rest of it, it would read as a rather mundane business text. When I take my hand off and I look at it, at the parts where they're citing Sun Tzu, I'm not seeing much of a real connection. So it almost reads to me like they're taking the ideas of Sun Tzu and just applying it to some preconceived notions where we're just bringing in this ancient text to try to add justification, perhaps in an exotic fashion.
Well, yeah, the text lends itself to that, right? Because it tends to be very general and not very specific. And I think you hit the nail on the head there, Tom, where it's almost like marketing, right? It'll sound more deep if I reference the connection to Sun Tzu, even though I may not have any. But so I thought that was very insightful. Just cover up the citations and then see what they say, and you realize, well, there's really not much to it. Good point.
So, I wanted to throw that out. It is being used in many of these contexts, but are we using it properly? Or what would be a proper usage of it? Because, you know, war and some of these other contexts that it's being applied towards, they're very different, totally different forms of competition.
Well, let me also just ask one more question going back to something Paul said in part one about the political changes and the economic changes. Would it be accurate that to say for the context it was written and for the, let's say, level one intended audience, war was business? As I've said before, this isn't my area background. I have an A level or AP level world history education with it, but if that is your role in the empire, if that is your role in your country, you are a salaried soldier, or at least you have some hope that your family back home isn't starving while you are out serving the emperor. This is your business, and all success rises and falls with your military success. So could we start from that position and interrogate it a bit from what you were saying before about whether this is the original business?
That's really, I hadn't thought about it that way. So I'm now going to be thinking out loud, which is always dangerous, but I'm an extrovert, and that's how we process information, is we gotta talk about our ideas. So we talk to think, where introverts will think before they talk, which is probably what I should be doing now. But you could, I honestly think you could make that interpretation, couldn't you? Because how do you expand your empire? And why do you need to? And so one of the reasons would be for an economic purpose. So you either have more citizens to feed, you have a larger army to sustain. So, hey, what's that kingdom over there got? They look like they got stuff we need or that we want. Or rule was very personal during this time, warlords. So it could be for the aggrandizement of their own personal power and their own personal fortunes, or that of their families in particular. I think that could be a way to look at war in the context of business, or what we would say is economics, where it's difficult to separate politics from economics, no matter when we're talking about it. So if we want to talk now about more kind of business, as in commerce and firms and that sort of part of economics, I think, yeah, we can certainly move in that direction as well, as a kind of subset, if you will, of economics.
If I can add to that, as sort of like a follow-on question too, is that not just economics, but also sort of like the politics of revenge. I mean, why would you have a sustained state of war over a long period of time? You can imagine where, all right, you would have a war, and then you'd settle out for an extended period of time, and and then when the new state ceases to function, then maybe you have another war. But this was a constant churn of war. There had to be a lot more passion and anger and lashing out or whatever that was fueling that. Would that not be the case?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you lost in a war, certainly revenge, reclaiming what was once yours, or as one of the qualities that Sun Tzu says a general should avoid having, would be too much honor. So if you have too much honor and you're too prideful, you can be goaded into attacking at the adversary's pleasure rather than at your own initiative, on your own initiative. So I think that's true. Even Sun Tzu makes a point about revenge without calling it revenge, but talking about this notion of, well, you don't want to have somebody who's, you know, too honorable or has too hot of a temper, because they can be angered into fighting before they're actually ready to fight.
Yeah, it's one of those extra things tossed in the chapter, and he has a lot like that where they'll start out one way and then he'll toss some other tidbits in. I just had one comment to what that really great question that Sarah asked. I think one way to view this is it's a treatise or a description of the understanding of warfare at the time it was written, 5th century BC, as Paul said, in the context of Chinese society and culture. And I don't know that that makes it inapplicable to future warfare, but you really do have to do quite a bit of an extrapolation to take some of the principles, where he's very specific about burning down houses and how to use fire and those kinds of things. You do quite a bit of extrapolation there. So I think where it's at its best, whether it's describing the game of golf or business applications or even modern warfare, is to look at the principles and then think about how they apply. And as he said, many times you have to think about when not to apply them or when not to obey the emperor. So that's how I see that. I'm curious what Paul's reaction to that is.
Yeah, you know, the more I think about it, this notion of application, misapplication, and who's doing it would be, it really, and this is sort of my own understanding, I don't know who else might share it, is that Sun Tzu's The Art of War really comes into American culture, not necessarily via the military. I mean, certainly there's that aspect for sure, but it really comes to us via Japan and our economic competition with them in the 1980s. where a lot of American business leaders were thinking, how are these guys eating our lunch over and over again with these deals that they're really good at making deals and really taking us to the cleaners? And so they figured out that Japanese businessmen were reading Sun Tzu's The Art of War, Sun Tzu's Bingfa, which had come to Japan in the 8th century AD. So, I mean, almost 1,500 years, give or take, after it had been written, it reaches Japan. So were the Japanese misapplying Sun Tzu's Bingfa in the way they were conducting business with Westerners? I'm not sure. Or it kind of goes back to what Sarah was talking about, as you mentioned, Ralph, where, well, that's the way that Japanese understood war at the time, was its economics. And because Japan had not been allowed to have an offensive military capability in the way that other nations had, perhaps their understanding then became more economically focused and financially focused. And that these larger business conglomerates then said, okay, if we're at war, you know, what books are out there that can help us understand how to operate in that arena? So I think perhaps we're kind of thinking that it came to us via the military, but in fact, it came to us through business practices of Japan in the 1980s.
What this interesting lineage, which I was not aware of, thank you, Paul, made me think, is that maybe there is something about a necessary misunderstanding for ideas to circulate, right? The Italians have this famous expression that whoever translates also is betraying the original idea, traduttore, traditore. And also, because just take the example of the Japan, one could argue that maybe the Japanese were misunderstanding Sun Tzu, but then we can also make the case that then the West and the rest of the world misunderstood some of the practices that Japanese managements were putting in place, right? So there's always eternal change.
Oh, misunderstanding the misunderstanding. Oh my gosh. That's a great point.
No, I was just going to, perhaps it'll jog your memory. I was going to talk more about your notion of necessary misunderstanding, which I sort of love. I'm going to sort of file that away for future use. There's a great book called Is That a Fish in Your Ear? Which is a book about translation, translating texts. And how do you do it? You know, what words do you choose to keep in the original language as you're translating it to kind of give the feeling of this is something exotic? So as we were talking about novels before we came back on it. Yeah, I need to kind of explore that more. There's another sociological term called positive dysfunction. An example would be that within, say, the poorest of poor areas, that somehow there is a family or several families where the children are getting enough to eat and they're also getting education, but nothing around them would lead that to be something that is a successful outcome, where you would say, oh, well, yeah, that's going to happen within this neighborhood or within this housing complex. It's so dysfunctional. Yeah, but somehow there's a family that's getting it done, that's getting it all correct. And so that may not be the same thing as a kind of necessary misunderstanding, but yeah, I'm going to have to think about that more. Thanks for that.
Yeah, I was going to say, when I think about necessary misunderstanding as applied to how I'm reading these other texts, you know, what is it that I was objecting to, I guess, is a way to put it. There is a tendency, I think, to put in a favorable squelch. So when you are reading Sun Tzu and you want to apply it to something, you look at it in all of the favorable terms, or you focus it on the favorable terms. And I suspect that what the Japanese were doing was doing much better critical application, which is to say what works, what doesn't work, what is applicable, you know, how do we actually put this into practice, which suggests that it's using the full text as opposed to just sort of memifying the simplest bullet and just taking that and running with it. Maybe there's a difference between what would be a good application versus a not as good application.
So I think Sun Tzu has an answer to that, because in one of the points he says, all men can see the tactics whereby I conquer, but what none can see is the strategy out of which victory is evolved. And I think he's making this in the context of, you know, how situation matters, how one should have and know the principles, but also understand that they matter differently in different situations, right? And I think that's why it makes the book impactful and interesting and relevant, is because it's trying to be analytical instead of just saying it's this answer forever for every situation, no matter what.
Right. I think that's a fair point. We could talk about different metaphors and comparisons for what war is. So a lot of some people say, well, war is just a duel on a bigger scale, or war is like a wrestling match where one wrestler is trying to impose their will on another. Sansa, in many respects, is almost like a dance between two partners, you and your adversary, that you're constantly adjusting yourself to the move of the other person. And that's also very much like many martial arts. Your first move is honestly to get the other person to move in a way that you want them to move so that you can win. So a lot of judo, a lot of aikido is using the force of the adversary against them. Is that you've manipulated them in such a way that now they're completely off balance. And so you've got them. You've got them where you want them. I like that thought.
Well, that's a great point, Paul, because he does talk about, or the text does speak to earlier, it's a combination. And the dance metaphor is a really good one, where it's about, you know, you have to know your own steps and you have to be organized and you have to run your army with discipline. But I couldn't tell you whether it's 50%, but another part of the dance is what your partner's doing and the things you do. I mean, good dancers are like this, where they set their partner up for success and help their partner achieve. And in this case, you want to do the opposite, but the whole idea is influence your partner, whether it's by baiting him or other activities that cause him to follow you down the mountain pass. That, I think, is a critical insight, that it's really just, it's not all about you. And there's a description from Grant's biography where they talk about Grant was mostly concerned about what he was going to do and not what the enemy was going to do. And that was an advantage for him, but there was times when it was a disadvantage because he'd blunder right into things where he wasn't thinking about, well, how could it be a difficult situation for him? So I think that dance part of it is a really nice way to think about that interaction of strategies where, yes, the enemy has free will, but Sansa emphasizes there's a lot you can do to shape what his options are. I really like that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you with respect to that analysis, Ralph. You know, then a larger question becomes, and this is sort of what Pedro mentioned in that quote, is, you know, what if you're caught, quote unquote, Sun Tzu-ing? You know, it's like, yeah, exactly. Well, I've been hanging around the military for too long. Where
I love it.
You know, nouns can become verb. And even proper nouns can become verbs, like Sun Tzu-ing. It's like, yeah, what if you're caught using deception in warfare? Is the answer then to out Sun Tzu the person or the adversary? We could argue that, well, that's what the United States did with Japan, is that over time we got very good at understanding how Japanese companies worked and operated and made their deals. Was it because we had a deeper understanding of Sun Tzu? Probably not, but we understood what Japan was doing and adapted. So that may be an interesting question to explore too. It's like, okay, well, your strategy's been revealed. You're attacking us where we're weak. You're using, you know, spies, etc., busted. So what's the answer?
Oh, well, what I was going to say was, for me, the comparison is less about the initiator and the enemy. But for me, the level I resonated with it was about the self and the ideal self. So the ideal self and the ought self, and how, as an instructional text, most readers would receive it as a comparison between where you are and where you should be. An ought self, a normative text, an instruction manual, a history. But for me, the way I received it was about a comparison to the ideal self. And I am impoverished in that I can't read or speak the original Chinese. And so I'm relying on the translations, the two different translations I've picked up. But none of them in none of them could you summarize it as a do as I did reporting. It's not a reflection on my successful history and the lessons that I now give to you, all of you future warriors and future successful leaders. It's very much, we are all a work in progress, and here's where we're going separately and together. And the reason I bring that up is because of the question you asked us, Tom, about what would be appropriate applications. And I think both because of the explicit text and because of these layers behind it that we're saying, the very natural extension that I think it would be difficult to argue with is parenting. So in chapter 10, again, terrain, but in, I think these are some of the most famous excerpts as well, but I will repeat them from the Giles translation here. In line 25 and 26, regard your soldiers as your children, and they will follow you into the deepest valleys. Look upon them as your own beloved sons, and they will stand by you even unto death. If, however, you are indulgent, but unable to make your authority felt, kind-hearted but unable to enforce your commands, and incapable, moreover, of quelling disorder, then your soldiers must be likened to spoilt children. They are useless for any practical purpose. And depending on your backgrounds as well, some of the Abrahamic traditions, the original books read the stories of creation and read out loud the stories of the founding fathers in the big capital Fs and the founding families, as we now like to call them, in this same way as a discussion of everything is parenting. Everything about the future generations is raising a family, leaving the generation after you better than yourself, bettering yourself, but more importantly, bettering everyone else. So I think, back to Tom's original provocation, if there had been Sun Tzu and the Art of Parenting, I would have picked that book up in the airport and probably had some very interesting reading on my own, discussions about family dynamics, because those two, I think, really give you an insight into, even if it weren't dictated by a leader up on high, even if it were a collection of oral history, and even if it's in the wrong order, somewhere in there, in a chapter about land, terrain, and planning your attack, is a reminder of how to treat, in this place, again, I'll come back to your employees. So how do you treat your employees? You treat them like children you need to develop. You don't spoil them. You can't bring them back from spoiling them. And here's how you do it. Points, points, points.
Well, Sarah, by the way, there is an edition, The Art of Parenting, Sun Tzu's Art of War for Parenting Teens. So it does exist.
Oh,
I kid you not. I thought golf was the limit, but no.
Oh, that was going to be the $1 million idea that we're going to take away. Always got to seize the high ground with children. And the ultimate high ground is because I said so.
Yeah.
That's where you win every argument.
Yeah, correct.
No, it's because Sun Tzu said so.
There you go.
Now you have authority you can quote. Sorry, Tom.
No, it's okay. I wanted to follow up on the idea of the ought self, because now, Paul, I don't know if this is based on a construct in the original Chinese or if this is just how the translation writes it. But when we're talking about the parents, in this case, the general, who I interpret in general as the commander or the leader of the troops, just an officer. The advice is given rather indirectly, isn't it? It says, if a general indulges his troops but is unable to employ them, if he loves them but cannot enforce his commands, etc., then the general is useless. Now, I had imagined, as I was reading this, the advisor talking to a general. So how do you advise a leader who you want to be very, very careful about, who might order your beheading, to behave or to act a certain way? It's to try to, talk rather indirectly, which even further aligns with what Sarah's point is, because if you're going to advise a parent, one who could take your advice rather emotionally the wrong way, this would be the way to go about it.
Yeah, I'm trying to digest that a bit more. I mean, we could say that Sun Tzu is, this is a general to general kind of conversation, in much in the same way, Tom, that you mentioned it. It's a parent to parent conversation about, about that, or a dog owner for that matter. When they're at the dog park and you're like, hey man, your dog is a little rough. with my dog, it's like, how do you approach that dog owner without offending them? So yeah, that's another way that we can put this particular text into context, which is, general to general conversation, as well as Sun Tzu talking to sovereigns, or having a text that is easily understood by people who are the fielded forces. or the adversary whose military you've now absorbed. There's a lot of richness in here, and it could be because of the fact, as we've been talking about, it is so concise and succinct that it's just easily digested that way.
So Paul said something that made me think broadly. So I'm going to spin the conversation a bit, right? And take advantage of the fact that now we have some experts in the military and so on. It seems that the text could be understood and speaks of ideas and principles from general to general, general to sovereign, general to soldier even. But what about soldier to general, right? And more so, it seems that a lot of the more specificities of war or combat are related to the geography and marching people and going around. When we know that today a lot of war is cyber, digital, through drones, so aerial, so to speak. And that reminded me of work by a colleague of mine at CBS, Madeline Rauch, and her co-author Shad Ansari, who had studied the arrival and use of drone technology in the military in the US. And they have paid particular attention to the emotional impact that this new technology had and the extent people had ways to cope with that, both formal and instructions given, but also peer-to-peer kind of advice. And actually the struggle that they went through because it was something so new that disrupted the general ideas and expectations on how war took place, on how combat took place. So if you were to reimagine some of the ideas we have from Sun Tzu in today's context of war and in looking from the bottom up, so to speak, right? What may we learn?
Boy, that is a big, deep question. I think that in the period of time in which this text emerged, let's put it that way, it would have been unlikely that a soldier would have been as brave to have a conversation with a general about a text. I think it was a very highly stratified society, much in the same era that Sun Tzu was writing. Confucius was also writing. So Confucius was looking at the Warring States period and saying, well, the way we get out of this is to reestablish that old feudal order. So the feudal order of subject being obedient to the emperor, son being obedient to the father, villager being obedient to the elder. So there would have been, I think, little in the way of kind of bottom-up kind of conversations with respect to Sun Tzu's Bingfa. For today, though, you know, Tom, you can probably talk more competently about this than I can, this notion of the strategic corporal, the ability to make larger decisions at ground level, and how that might reflect what Sun Tzu has, you know, talked about.
So there's a couple of passages. Maybe I don't know if it's necessarily the text. It may have been some of the commentaries in Griffith. But indeed, one of the things that I took away from it was how much more valuable equipment, horses or chariots were than people. And a lot of the text is written that way. Now, in terms of direct communication, right, I wouldn't have expected it either. But I did sense that there was an interest in Sun Tzu's writing of paying attention to one's own people. It may not be that they are going to say something directly to the leader, but their disposition, their energy levels were considered to be very, very important. And I felt that the part of the advice was that the general had to pay attention to what signals they were getting from their own forces. So these people were not to be treated or seen as expendable. Again, going back to the problems of attrition, the problems of exhausting yourself. If you exhaust yourself for no purpose, then it's really bad. We take that to a much, much greater extreme now in the present day because the troops do have much, much, much more of a voice. And a lot of that comes from professionalism. One of the other things I took from this text, too, is that the professionalism of generals was relatively new, as I understand it. It was not a professional. It was not professional to the same extent. So the notion of like the generals having particular authorities, responsibilities that were transferable with the office was developing. And part of the conversation that I took from the section where we're talking about paying attention to the disposition of your own forces was part of that emphasis on professionalization or on emphasis on professionalism, that you are entrusted with these forces and you should use them efficiently and should pay attention to how they are, because if you overmarch them, they will be exhausted and unable to fight when they get to the next battle, for example. So go ahead, Paul.
No, I completely agree with you on that, about how the generals and the soldiers, how the generals would be particularly mindful of the morale of their troops, and so would be interested in sort of hearing from them in that perspective. My point was, I don't think that the soldiers, the foot soldiers, would have held up, you know, Sun Tzu's Art of War to the general and said, you know what, terrain, you're not paying attention to terrain, general. I think we can have this conversation about it. I think that is probably right out, you know. And I don't know today. I don't think, you know, a sergeant would feel comfortable going to the general and say, look, hey, looking at the FM, the field manual, I think you're violating this part. So that was my point. I think the morale portion, absolutely, that the general would have to be mindful of the disposition of his forces and their outlook, for sure, no question.
I think one chapter that I thought particularly interesting was Variation in Tactics, because he talks about you can't just rely on the enemy not coming, you have to be ready to receive him, and the fact... he has this quote, a statement that he makes, you can't rely on the chance of his non-attacking, but rather the fact that we made our position unassailable, you know, whether it's great defenses or business strategy or something. But the other part I really liked about that chapter, and I'd like to get reaction from the team, because I'm trying to do this the way Sarah recommended, which I love, which is don't read it by yourself and see what other people think. And he mentions in that section something that resonated particularly with me, and that is the dangerous faults which may affect a general. So very insightful. Instead of just saying, well, you should do this, you should do that, so it's a little bit more than an instruction manual. In this part, he talks about how your biases and weaknesses can work against you. And Paul made a reference to this earlier on one of the items, but he mentions five, and perhaps there's more than five, but the five, calls them the five dangerous faults. They are recklessness, cowardice, hasty temper, a delicacy of honor, which is sensitive to shame. That's what Paul was talking about, having an overly large or magnified sense of honor that causes you to get your blood up, as Lee said at Gettysburg. And then over solicitude of the men, right? On the one hand, you want to look after the men and treat them as your children, but you can't do it, otherwise you risk spoiling them, which Sarah mentioned earlier. I just wanted to see what other people thought about that focus on the potential weaknesses of a general to which he must be aware. I mean, that's not so easy to do personally, but still, I thought it was really, if we're talking 5th century BC, he's doing this psychological analysis of failure traits of generals.
Yeah, that last portion is often surprising to people, but and sometimes it's translated as compassionate. You don't want to be too compassionate for your men, because you may love them so much or feel compassion towards them too greatly that you will not act when you need to act, because you're actually afraid that you know, you're going to kill people that you like.
Or you'll love them too much. Right. And some generals, I don't remember which general said this, but it comes up many times when generals talk about actual war and not business strategy. They say, you have to be prepared to give orders that you know will almost certainly lead to the death of the people that you order. And it's a pretty stark reminder that of that kind of moral courage that's necessary. Right, because they've always acted like the numbers, the people were kind of expendable, or the numbers were their greatest asset. That's very insightful. Yeah, would that change? Because Tom was talking about the professionalization of the U.S. Army. And in World War II, we kind of had that numbers are better kind of strategy, and now we don't. And so we actually seek ways to avoid conflict or direct to large numbers of casualties, just like Sun Tzu counsels. So in many ways, we've come full circle. And I think that's a really interesting thing to think about. Would that change how the Chinese approach war. And maybe it wouldn't, because the generals tend to be kind of old school about this, but it's certainly going to have an impact on how the people respond.
Yeah. And if you think about, we're sort of, kind of pulling more towards the military interpretation of Sun Tzu, but the notion of, has the American way of war changed over time? Because it was at one point, as you suggest, Ralph, a lot of men, a lot of materiel, just throw it at the enemy and attrit the hell out of them. So as Churchill said about the Americans entering World War II, here comes the big steamroller. It's like, yep, he knew the American way of war was just throw a lot of men and material at it, just like the Union did against the South. It's like, the Southern folks are like, we tried to fight fair, but those Yankees just kept on coming, for sure. But now have we sort of translated into, or not translated, but sort of moved more towards
evolved,
we want it.
Evolved.
Yeah, evolved. Yeah, yeah, evolved. It's like, yeah, we want it quick. We want it over, minimal casualties. Yeah, absolutely. Get us home before Christmas.
So I have a reflective question as we get towards the end of our conversation. And Paul was just talking about changes in the way of war. And for some reason, that got me thinking about the way of organizing war or the military, right? And we discussed in part one how Sun Tzu can be read as a text about winning, how it has been used by the Japanese business managers, right? And how that's led to ideas that in turn influenced practice in the US. We know from history that ideas about bureaucracy that Weber has written came from understanding the Prussian army. So there's a lot of insight that was wielded from the way that military have worked throughout history. And since, Ralph, Paul, and Tom have this experience in the military, and Tom and Paul particularly in these more educational roles, right? I wondered, what do you think are the insights from today's military leadership or management or organizing in general that can speak to current challenges, to current situations, to our current context?
I'll take a first stab at that because I work in the leadership and management arenas, in addition to the passages we were just recently talking about with the, what are leadership qualities we wish to avoid. I also look very much at the relationship between the military and the sovereign as expressed in this. One of the things that struck me was just how much Sun Tzu was advocating for very strict separation. They trust the military to make proper military decisions. And I have to assume that part of that advice probably stems from a sense of that the sovereigns at the time were in some way exercising undue influence, either withholding or overflowing the military flush with resources or something to that nature, which the military itself did not feel they had the autonomy to make the proper decisions. I think that balance of what is right, because it's not one, it's not a one extreme or the other. It's a partnership. It's a relationship that has to be built. It's embedded in just about everything we're talking about because, the military is a public sector organization and it's beholden at the government in the same way that, say, businesses are beholden to shareholders or stakeholders. That external relationship is critical in order for the military to have what it's supposed to have and to be able to do what it needs to do to support the security interests of its nation.
Yeah, and because I teach in a different department from Tom, my perspective obviously would be just a bit different as well. So I teach in the Department of National Security and Strategy. So I think what we largely speaking the big kind of strategic level view of things, where I think Sun Tzu makes sense is when we talk about this concept called gray zone warfare, or war in the gray zone. So black and white, white being peace, black being kind of this notion of conventional warfare, armies crossing borders and having these big battles. But in the gray, it's kind of a weird mixture of, is this peace? Not really. Is this war in the same sense that we understand conflict? So two examples. One would be Russia's annexation of Crimea, where they were able to achieve warlike effects without really using a conventional military to seize territory. They kind of did it all on the down low. And they may be trying to do that with Eastern Ukraine as well right now. The other, I'll get back to that in a minute. The other one would be China's activities in the South China Sea, where it's actually taking territory. It's altering the status quo. It's building islands and claiming them, but not using the military. They're certainly putting military assets on these islands, but it's largely construction companies or oil companies that or fishing fleets, quote unquote, that are more kind of covert. Yeah, they're certainly organized by the PLA, but they're not the PLA themselves doing this. It's not the PLA Navy just conquering islands and seizing territory. So that's war in the gray zone. Going back to Russia and the current situation in Ukraine, well, we're kind of wise to this trick. So it could be what's happening with Putin's amassing of forces on the border. Is this merely deception? That really what he's doing is he's just kind of keeping up the tensions for his own internal politics. Is he getting really what he wants anyway, where Ukraine will not be part of NATO, not be closer to the West? Or, as you know, there may be some indications now that what Putin is going to try is a provocation, that he will organize some sort of event that is on the Ukrainian side that is actually forces him to act. Put that all in quotation marks, like, well, you know, I tried to do this the right way. Let's see what the Ukrainians have done to Russians in Ukraine. I'm the only one who can protect them. I'm going to roll in. So I think that's where we can now look at another way to apply Sun Tzu, is at that big kind of grand strategy level of gray zone warfare.
Well, I had a blast, Paul, listening to you think out loud, because I do the same thing. So you verbalizing some of those things, that I did some of that myself, and I was able to think and then bounce off some of the things that you said. So I think we're of like mind about that. And I always find these conversations illuminating.
No, thank you. It was a joy. I always try to sign up for at least one episode a season that will challenge me. And so far, this was it. And I loved meeting you, Paul, and learning from you. This was wonderful.
Hey, thank you for having me. I learned a great deal, and I really like this new understanding of collective interpretation. I learned a ton. 2 hours flew by for me. I can't believe that I mean, this could go for me another couple of hours, but but I want to release people to live their own lives.
Special thanks to our guest, Paul Kahn, for joining us on this episode. And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.